So what happens if the super committee
doesn't come up with anything super?
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles. Hello, happy Friday. I'm Steve Chiotakis.
Happy Friday. I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org. Today is Friday, November 18th.
Coming up, tensions run high between European leaders over a controversial tax plan.
Boeing makes a huge sale. Will that mean jobs here in the U.S.?
And speaking of airliners, Jeremy, some passengers headed to England paid money to not be stuck on the tarmac. We'll explain.
Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
There are just 5 days left for the group of 12 congressional members hoping to find $1.2 trillion in cuts to the nation's budget deficit over the next decade. But getting there has been really tough.
Democrats want tax hikes. Republicans want cuts to Medicaid and Medicare. There have been tiny hints of compromise, but so far, no deal. And if there is no deal, automatic cuts would take place.
Well, let's talk about it now, how all this could play out. And Jill Schlesinger, editor-at-large at CBS Money Watch, is with us now from New York, as she is every Friday morning. Morning, Jill.
Good morning.
I know the last time we had a big budget showdown in the Congress, the U.S. credit rating got downgraded. Could that happen again?
I don't think so. Ratings agencies have said that while a super committee failure would be negative, these agencies do expect $1.2 trillion in planned cuts to occur one way or another, so their ratings outlooks remain unchanged right now.
One way or another. All right. So how are the folks on Wall Street watching all of this, your friends down there in the lower Manhattan?
I'd say with a sense of bemusement and disdain. Look, if no deal occurs next week, the super committee could actually put in place a mechanism to address these issues next year. Maybe it's a super duper committee. Markets should be satisfied with that action. But if nothing happens next year and credit agencies do consider another downgrade, investors are going to get nervous and we could see another swoon just like the one we saw during that debt ceiling debacle in August.
I think we have more stuff to add to the lexicon here. Super duper committee.
I love it.
Jill Schlesinger from CBS Money Watch. Jill, thanks.
Take care.
Well, it looks like there are at least three possible outcomes that could emerge from the super committee. A really impressive deal that gets the job done, a deal full of accounting tricks and rosy scenarios, or no deal at all, which would trigger those automatic spending cuts. For more, let's bring in Mark Zandi, who is chief economist with Moody's Analytics. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Mark, which of those three possibilities looks most likely to you at this point?
Well, Jeremy, I'll take a fourth option, and that is I think the super committee will come up with something substantive, not $1.2 trillion, but let's say half that. I think there's enough agreement on the committee to come up with about $600 billion in deficit reduction. And of course, if they can do that, they'll avoid some of the more draconian automatic spending cuts that would occur otherwise in 2013.
And is that kind of sort of half solution going to be enough to satisfy the markets and avoid, for instance, another downgrade of U.S. debt?
Yes, I think that would be sufficient. I think if they did something counterproductive, gimmicks, as you said, that would be a problem. That would be the fodder for a downgrade, and that would be a problem for financial markets. If they came up with something really big and got it all together, that would be great. We'd be off and running. But I think they're going to come up with something that will just appease financial markets and we'll go on to the next step here.
And the next step, I assume, is putting things off until after the next election. Is there any sense that lawmakers are going to be in any better mood to make big, difficult decisions, whether it be budget cuts or tax increases, after the election of 2012 than they are now?
No, but to some degree they have no choice, because under current law, if they do nothing, tax rates for everybody will go up on January 1st, 2013. Those are the expiration of the so-called Bush tax cuts. So we're going to have to see a piece of tax legislation after the election. So they may not want to do it, but they'll have no choice.
And you don't think the Bush tax cut extension is going to be part or letting them expire is going to be part of this deal?
Well, it's hard to handicap all of this. It's possible, but I doubt it. I think that's too big a bite for them to chew. And so I think they'll have to wait till after the election to address it. And at that point, they'll have no choice, but they'll have to do something.
All right. Finally, the big question, Mark. What is at stake for ordinary Americans as we near this deal next week?
There's a lot at stake. If the super committee does something counterproductive, then we're going to have a problem. The economy is already fragile, and this could push it into recession. If they did something big, this would be really great and send us off to the races. Hopefully, they get it together well enough that they do no damage.
Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's Analytics, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And one more take this morning from David Kelly, who is chief market strategist at JP Morgan Funds. He's with us from New York. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
So, David, what do you think? What are you expecting from the super committee?
Well, I'm afraid it's most likely going to be no deal at all. I think the problem is that neither side really has an incentive to do a deal here.
But many people who raise the big red warning flags about our debt situation, our long-term debt situation, say, look, we better do something soon or we're going to end up like Greece. I mean, if we keep punting this thing along, is that a fair situation?
No, not at all. I mean, if you look at our total debt, our net debt relative to the size of our economy, it's about 70% right now, 70% of GDP. In Greece, it's 160% of GDP. We've got a long, stable democracy. We have the ability to do this. We just need to make some adjustments both on the entitlement side and the revenue side. If we do that, we can deal with this problem.
David Kelly, chief market strategist with JP Morgan Funds. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
Well, now over to Europe's debt crisis. Jeremy and David, I know David was talking about Greece. Let's talk about Spain now, which prepares to vote for a new government this weekend. Spain is the latest Eurozone country to feel the pressure from the bond markets. Yesterday, Spain had its highest bond yield since 1997, dangerously close to the 7% interest rate that indicates investors may not have confidence that Spain will repay its debts. The BBC's Sarah Rainsford is with us from Madrid with the latest on that story. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning.
How does this election play into the economic situation there?
It's hugely important. The economy is really the only issue anyone's been talking about. All the candidates and the whole of Spanish society wanting to know how this general election can change a very dire situation in Spain, where almost 5 million people are unemployed. And in some parts of the country, more than 50% of the young workforce is out of work. So very difficult situation and absolutely critical to solving Spain's problems.
And we've also seen the rate, the interest rate for Spain to borrow going up and up. What does that mean?
Well, it means that whoever is in power after this election will have a huge task on its hands, a really big challenge to convince investors, to convince the financial markets that Spain is solvent, that it can pay back its debts, and to bring those borrowing costs down to a sustainable level. Now, what we're expecting is to see huge austerity measures here, a lot more spending cuts, particularly in the public sector. And I think what that means is we're going to see a lot of social unrest here, as people are going to be very, very unsatisfied that things are already difficult and they're going to get much tougher.
Yeah, social unrest. I mean, what are the people on the streets of Madrid and elsewhere in Spain thinking about all of this?
Well, there's a mixture. I mean, you have to take into account that it looks like the opposition Popular Party, a centre-right party, is going to win by a landslide. So there's a lot of support for tough measures, for what people see here as a safe pair of hands to take over the government. But on the other hand, there's a lot of more traditional left-wing voters who are extremely worried.
The BBC Sarah Rainsford in Madrid. Sarah, thank you.
Thank you.
Couple of bits of earnings news here in this country to tell you about. The clothing chain known as The Gap saw its profit drop by more than a third last quarter. The company that owns hundreds of Banana Republic, Old Navy, and Gap stores reported more sales drops at stores open more than a year.
And the company whose sauce is made with 57 ingredients, Jeremy, said today it's missing something. Growth. Heinz said sales were down slightly by 1% and profit fell by nearly 6%, meaning it'll likely raise prices on ketchup and some other items, close some of its plants, and lay off some workers, too.
You can find more numbers, business news, and podcasts, and all kinds of other things at our website, marketplace.org, the all-new marketplace.org.
Chock
if you haven't been there, go check it out.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
Now to the marketplace global perspective. British Prime Minister David Cameron meets today with his German counterpart Angela Merkel in Berlin, and the two leaders are expected to clash over a proposed tax hike that could go into effect all over Europe, a tax that would help countries deal with their debt. Marketplace's Stephen Beard explains.
Germany and France are both rooting for the so-called Robin Hood tax. This would take money from Europe's rich financial institutions and give it to Europe's poor, over-indebted governments. The proposal is to levy a charge on all financial transactions, like the sale of shares, bonds, and fancy derivatives. It's believed this could raise $70 billion a year. But Britain, with Europe's biggest finance industry, is vehemently opposed. And with good reason, claims Philip Booth of the Free Market Institute of Economic Affairs.
Financial transactions will just disappear to another part of the world. No money will be raised, and an awful lot of the financial services industry will be substantially undermined.
He believes much of the business would flee to New York and other financial centres. In his talks with the German leader today, the British Prime Minister will underline his opposition to the tax, pointing out that financial services account for 15% of the UK economy. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Well, usually when there's a signing ceremony and President Obama is there, he's the one doing the signing, but not today in Indonesia. The president stood watching as executives from airplane maker Boeing signed a deal to sell 230 aircraft to an Indonesian carrier called Lion Air. The White House claims the deal will create 110,000 jobs right here in the United States. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler fact-checks that number.
Boeing won't specify how many people will be hired, but spokesman Doug Alder says Boeing has added 12,000 new jobs this year, and it expects similar increases going forward.
So as we add jobs here, our suppliers have to keep up with us as we increase production, and that in turn causes them to add more jobs. So it's the ripple effect across the entire U.S. economy.
Spread across suppliers, experts say that figure of 110,000 jobs probably isn't far off.
I don't have a big problem with the arithmetic, but I do have a few academic quibbles.
That's Gary Huffbauer with the Peterson Institute for International Economics. His quibble is with the timeline.
These jobs are going to be over a period of years, probably at least 4 years.
Boeing says it will be more than a year before it even begins production of its new 737 MAX aircraft. So the deal may result in 110,000 jobs, just not overnight. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
A new global climate change report out today says the world should be prepared for more hot weather in the summer and extreme weather events year-round, so says the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sarah Gardner reports.
The IPCC is the international group that studies climate change and its impacts. Today's report is probably its most solution-oriented. It says extreme weather is here, expect more of it, and the world needs to get ready. Sharon Lurig at the Nonprofit Investor Coalition Ceres says that means everything from higher seawalls to early storm warning systems.
We have to take steps to make sure that we are not losing our shirts, losing people, losing valuable property every time a new extreme event plays out, because there's only going to be more of them.
Scientist Jay Gulledge at the Center for Climate and Energy Solutions says this is really about defending against known risks, just like the military does.
Climate change should be handled in a very similar way because it is a very serious threat.
Today's report is careful not to overstate climate predictions. The IPCC got egg on its face several years ago when it mistakenly claimed that Himalayan glaciers could disappear by 2035. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Well, the United Nations said today that 250,000 people face imminent starvation in Somalia. A major famine there has already killed tens of thousands this year, and many Somalis have fled to these refugee camps opening up in Kenya, in Nairobi, and other cities there. And as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports, it appears a new economy is starting up in those camps.
This is the sound of a permanent refugee camp. Schools, birthing centers, and convenience stores. This shack sprung up 2 months ago, built by Somali refugee Abdi Nasar Omar Ali. He hawks everything from shampoo packets to gumballs to spaghetti. Thank the Italian colonialists for that.
I used to be a very well-known businessman in Somalia. I sold auto parts from Mogadishu to Dubai.
But in the last couple of years, Islamic extremists known as Al-Shabaab destroyed his business model.
They would come to my shop, value my items, and say, you will pay us this much. Some businessmen gave 30% of their goods, others 50%.
This taxation is a key money source for Shabaab, as overseas support for the group has drifted away to jihadist battles elsewhere in Yemen and Saudi Arabia, says Tony Burns. He's with a Somali aid group.
Somalia has now become an economic backwater for international jihadis. Al-Shabaab has suffered accordingly. It is trying to raise new modes of taxation from within the indigenous population
and driving them out. Ali, the shop owner, packed up his wife and his 10 kids and paid smugglers $250 to get them out to Kenya. Here, he says his small business is already worth 50% more than when he started. Elsewhere in the camp, more entrepreneurs. A blacksmith, a tailor, a fruit seller. So many transplanted businessmen have left home. And yet, Somali-American Sadia Ali Aden clings to hope. She's just back from Mogadishu.
I met medical students. I met high school students. Mogadishu University became ranking 29th university in all of African colleges. This is the beauty of Somalia that people need to build on.
If and when peace comes to Somalia. Till then, hundreds of thousands of Somali entrepreneurs do their business on the outside. In the Dadaab refugee camp in Kenya, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Well, now to a man who is suing Bank of America, Steve. Mm. According to the Tampa Tribune, this man opened an account decades ago, and as of 2003, he had put about $59,000 into it.
A little savings account, yeah.
That's right, that's right. But he didn't touch it, really. And then he went back and he checked his balance in 2005, and the account only had $1,400 in it. And so he investigated this, and he is suing now because he alleges that Bank of America mixed up his account with another man of the same name.
Well, and this guy, what is it,
gave
Bob
that
Smith
man
or
all of his money.
Well, is it Fred Johnson?
Yeah, something you'd think something really obvious.
Jeremy Hobson?
No. His name, Konstantinos Alexopoulos.
That sounds like a relative.
See, now, when I first read that story, I thought, you know, this is so hilarious because Bank of America, what a mistake they made.
Right.
On second reading of it, I sort of feel like this guy's going to have a tough case to prove.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is reporting this morning that teenage girls are having fewer babies than ever before. The birth rate, the teenage birth rate, has hit its lowest level since 1940 when the government started keeping track. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
Not so long ago, demographers were worried about rising teen birth rates, egged on by celebrity moms like Bristol Palin and the movie Juno.
There it is. That little pink plus sign is so unholy.
So what happened in the space of a few years?
Less sex and more contraception.
That's Bill Albert with the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy. He says the rise in teen birth rates in 2006 and 2007 was a blip in a long period of declines. He credits better sex education for last year's big drop and the bad economy.
Now, I'm not here to suggest that teens are checking the Dow Jones average before they hop into the sack, but they're not immune to the business cycle either.
Albert says teens are watching their parents and neighbors struggle, so they may think better of starting families. And adults are having fewer babies, too. Birth rates for all age groups fell, except for women in their early 40s, who don't have the luxury of waiting for the economy to improve. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Jeremy, you know what this weekend is, right?
The weekend before Thanksgiving?
It is indeed the weekend before we're going to chow down next week. But it's also the opening weekend of the latest saga in the Twilight series.
Uh-huh.
Yes, Team Edward. Are you Team Jacob?
I'm whatever you want me to be, Steve, I'll be.
Team Jeremy. That's
Team
who
Jeremy.
You are.
There
that's right. What about all those crazy fans, though, you know, that line up outside movie houses on opening night? I mean, they're like there in tents and stuff or sleeping bags.
I think those are the Occupy movie theater protesters.
Is that what they are? The Occupy movie theater. I like that. Occupy cinema. And, you know, not just for Twilight, but also for other big movies, too. Harry Potter. I mean, we've seen
them. Yeah, they get in line
in
go
a lot of
midnight
movies.
Showings.
Would you line up for hours?
I think I might have done that once or twice in my life. I don't know about hours, but I've gone to those first shows right when they
opened. I did that for a CD. I did that when U2's Joshua Tree came out. I lined up for hours and hours to wait for midnight.
Well, anyway. Here to talk about the people that line up in hours for movies with us for our Midday Extra is Brent Lang, who's a reporter at TheWrap.com, and he's with us on the line from here in Los Angeles. Good morning.
Good morning.
So first of all, Brent, is this something that only happens with certain movies, or is this something that we're going to see going forward in all kinds of movies?
Well, it's becoming sort of an industry standard for movies to have some kind of midnight presence, particularly big studio films, but it's pretty rare that it gets this kind of reaction. You don't see tents being pulled out for most films.
Why midnight? Why? I mean, don't people need sleep? I mean, I know I do.
Well, I do as well. I'm not going to be one of those people out there. But if you are a teenage girl and you are obsessed with Robert Pattinson, for example, midnight, it's a small price to pay to stay up that late. And I think it also creates a sense of an event around a film, and there's a real desire to be part of the conversation, to be able to say in school the next day, you know, I saw Breaking Dawn or The Dark Knight or before anybody else did. So midnight screenings are becoming pretty standard, but not at this level.
Hmm. Do we have any sense of whether a movie that opens with a midnight screening ends up doing much better at the box office than one that does not?
Well, it's a little difficult to determine because a lot of the movies that have midnight screenings are films that are on track to do pretty monster box office. It can be a relatively infinitesimal part of a film's opening gross, or in the case of Twilight, it could be responsible for nearly a quarter of its opening weekend.
You know, Brent, how do studios or the theaters themselves decide to run a movie at midnight? I mean, what goes into the decision-making process?
Well, a lot of it comes down to the film itself. If it's a movie that skews towards a more youthful audience, if it's a film that has a real built-in audience already, it's going to be more likely to get a midnight show. Something like Lord of the Rings, something like J. Edgar, probably not going to have a midnight screening.
You know, there's a Starbucks, Brent, that's near our offices. It's like the only thing that opens, you know, at 5 o'clock in the morning. We always head over there, you know, when we really need some coffee. And I remember the day that the latest Harry Potter movie came out, both of the employees were gone because they were both seeing the midnight showing of Starbucks and they didn't come into work.
Yeah.
So have you seen a movie at midnight recently, Brent?
To be honest, the last movie I saw at midnight was one of the Lord of the Rings movies.
Oh, there you go.
And now I'm too old to stay up.
Oh, late. Surely not, Brent. Come on. You don't need sleep like the rest of us.
Well, Brent Lang of TheWrap.com, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Brent.
Well, we've got a week to go until all those big bargains kick off the all-important holiday shopping season. Well, kick off might be a—I think we've already kicked it off, we're there. But the big one starts next Friday, of course, Black Friday. And some will be opening as early as Thursday night, as in Thanksgiving night.
Jeez.
But that's making some people mad, like employees who are going to have to work, and some shoppers who've started petitions calling for stores to open later. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports.
Anthony Hardwick has worked for Target for 3 years, and this is how he learned about the store's midnight opening on the day after Thanksgiving.
You know, it was just kind of like, this is what you'll be working on Black Friday. Take it or leave it. And most people are so desperate to keep their jobs that, you know, obviously we've got to take it.
Hardwick has a full-time job elsewhere and only works part-time at Target. So he started an online petition, calling on the chain to sleep in until the lazy hour of 5 a.m.
I felt that I needed to stand up for the folks who are full-time and Target's their only job.
His petition has drawn over 150,000 supporters and inspired similar complaints against other early openers like Walmart, Toys R Us, and the outlet chain Tanger's. Rick Malorani started a petition calling on Best Buy to open later. He says he's building on the work of another movement.
Occupy Wall Street has given us a good push, and people are starting to say, you know, we don't just have to lay down and take it. We do have options. We can get noticed.
What the Occupy movement has done more than anything, it has changed the dialogue.
Sociology professor Richard Sullivan of Illinois State University says workers are at the point where they're telling their employers they can't take it anymore.
My pay hasn't gone up. I don't have good benefits. My hours might have been cut back. And now I have to go in on Thanksgiving.
Both Hardwick and Melorani say they'll be able to eat their Thanksgiving dinners whenever they want. Since they started their online petitions, their managers have let them know they'll have the early shift off. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
And finally today, passengers last weekend sat for hours on the tarmac in Vienna, Austria, Jeremy, not because of weather or mechanical problems. It was a standoff that erupted between the Comtel Airlines flight crew and more than 180 passengers. The crew wanted money for jet fuel to finish the last leg of the flight, which originated, by the way, in India and was headed to Birmingham, England. After 6 hours, security guards escorted passengers off the aircraft to the terminal's ATM, the cash machines, right, where they collected more than $31,000 to pay for the fuel to get to Birmingham.
Wait, Steve, hang on. Let me just write something down. Just write, never take Comtel.
is that – now I'm thinking about this $31,000, right? Is that gas money or, say, ransom?
I don't know. Well, I guess we'll have to wait and see how this story unfolds. Well, in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Steve Chiotakis. Have a great weekend. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.